طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we take another long look at the Palestinian right of return, a right carved in international law that is non-negotiable in any kind of proposed settlement between Palestine and Israel. And like our Bill of Rights, guarantees rights which extend to the individual. You are about to hear excerpts from a forum at the Right of Return Conference held at the NYU Law School a few months ago. It begins with an introduction of both the issue and the speakers.
I want to start by thanking NYU Students for Justice in Palestine, as well as all the co-sponsors for this event, Palestine Works, the Center for Human Rights and Social Justice here at the law school, the student chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, as well as Law Students for Human Rights for really facilitating this very important conversation. I think the right of return is often not discussed, and it remains one of the most fraught issues that are really at the heart of the current dispute. For Palestinians, the right of return represents a core right. And for many, this conflict will not be resolved until you deal with the reality today, where Palestinian refugees are denied the right to return to their ancestral homeland, while the law of return in Israel allows members of the Jewish community in the United States or in any other country to move to Israel and to become citizens on the spot. Whereas for Israelis, for many Israelis, the right of return represents a political question, a non-starter, and a threat to the existential identity of the state. And as Aman alludes to as well, we deal with a situation where Palestinian refugees represent actually a number larger than the population of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So while so much discussion focuses on the situation in the occupied territories, the reality remains that unless you have a viable, sustainable solution for the Palestinian refugee crisis, you will not ever fully resolve this question. So it's an important conversation, but thankfully we have a really incredible group of people here today to discuss it. So starting to my immediate left, we have Emilio David, who is a Palestine Law Fellow at Columbia University Center for Palestine Studies during the current year. He's also the Director of International Law and the Human Rights Program at Al-Quds University, and his work aims to shed light on the role that judicial phenomenon play in social logical and anthropological questions, and more specifically on the disciplinary powers of law and the discourse of human rights in contemporary colonial Palestine. Emilio will be speaking second in addressing the PA's legislation and policy around the right of return. To Emilio's left, we have, of course, Jamil Daqwar, who is director of the ACLU's human rights program, where he oversees human rights research, documentation, advocacy, and litigation before international human rights bodies. Before joining the ACLU, Jamil was with Human Rights Watch, and he previously worked at Adala, who, as I'm sure is familiar to many in the room, a very prominent organization. And he has filed and argued human rights cases before Israeli courts and international fora. To Jamil's left, we have Michael Litwin, a lifelong activist. Michael is a public defender in Brooklyn, former president of the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys in UAW Local 2325, and co-founder of Labor for Palestine and Jews for Palestinian Right of Return. He also has participated in attorney delegations to Palestine, Egypt, and in successful campaigns for Stevie Wonder to observe the BDS movement and the boycott of Israeli Zimline ships more recently. I should have mentioned Jamil will speak first after Michael's introduction and discuss the issue of displacement and return in Israel today. And Michael will round out the panel by talking about how activists are responding to the marginalization of the right of return and also how the right in return fits into larger human rights advocacy. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Michael to give a brief introduction to the Palestinian refugee question, and then we'll begin with our speakers.
It's an honor to be here with distinguished fellow panelists, and particularly I want to thank the organizers of this event, Aman, Omar, and NYU Students for Justice in Palestine, especially for having braved the witch hunt type atmosphere that seeks to silence supporters of Palestinian rights so much today that I know you mentioned, or was mentioned earlier at NYU, but is much broader than that. And I just want to start by saying that, you know, in 1964, there was a free speech movement throughout the University of California to advocate civil rights for black people, which was shut down by the university. That the advocacy was until this mass movement, the free speech movement, developed. And today, 52 years later, there really is a new free speech movement, and that free speech movement is to advocate the rights of Palestinians. And this explains, I think, the solidarity in recent times between black freedom activists, actually going all the way back to the 1960s, with Palestinians, and which has been reclaimed today in the form of groups like Black for Palestine, which arose from Ferguson and the Black Lives Matter movement. And as has been mentioned earlier, the heart of the Palestinian struggle for freedom is refugees' right of return, as reflected in UN Resolution 194, which I know will be mentioned and discussed in more detail by the other panelists, as well as in the three demands of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, movement, that calls for not only an end to the occupation of Palestinian land and full equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, but above all for the right of return of refugees throughout historic Palestine. And I think the purpose of this conference and this discussion is to explain why that is and how, or at least to shed some light on it. And by way of getting at why, it seems to me we have to start with what. And the what are 7 million, the number of Palestinian refugees today, who constitute 70% of the entire Palestinian people, many in refugee camps in the West Bank, Gaza, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. Interestingly, the majority of these refugees still live within 60 miles of their historic homeland. Indeed, 80% of the 1.8 million people in Gaza, what has been called the world's largest open-air prison, are refugees from 1948 Palestine, what Palestinians and many others call what the Israeli state claims to be. And that includes, by the way, the village of Sderot, where supposedly the Israelis are constantly being bombarded by Palestinian missiles, supposedly. Interestingly, that's a village a place that was founded in 1951 on lands that belonged to the Palestinian Arab village of Najd, which was destroyed by the Israeli state. Which brings us into how and why. In a word, Zionism, the establishment of a Jewish state and the artificial creation and maintenance of a Jewish majority in 1948 Palestine through the forced removal of the indigenous Palestinian people. That's why there are 7 million Palestinian refugees. Think Indian removal and manifest destiny in the United States, and you'll have a pretty good idea of what that has meant in Palestine. In 1948, this Jewish state was established through the Nakba, or catastrophe, which consisted of erasure and occupation of more than 500 Palestinian towns and villages, dispossession of over 750,000 Palestinians, in a terror campaign of which the massacre at Deir Yassin is emblematic. Since 1967, Israel has occupied and colonized the remainder of historic Palestine. And today, this, as you will hear from the other panelists, this relentless ethnic cleansing continues, armed and financed by the United States, our own government, and its allies. And this has created a diaspora of Palestinian refugees that is reflected in this well-known map, Palestinian Land Loss, that shows how settler colonialism in Palestine has reduced Palestinian land ownership. And there are maps very similar to this in regard to Native American land loss in this country. And the same could be said of other settler colonial societies. Because this Jewish state cannot exist without this ongoing ethnic cleansing, Zionists insist on the surrender of Palestinian right of return. Conversely, those who uphold human rights believe that refugees' right of return is essential, fundamental, and non-negotiable. As BDS founder Omar Barghouti puts it, quote, "The right of return is a basic right that cannot be given away. It's inalienable." That's why I work with Al Outa in New York, the Palestine Right of Return Coalition. That's why I'm here today for Jews for Palestinian Right of Return. And with that, I will turn it over to my fellow panelists.
Let me start with thanking the organizers and the law school's Student for Justice in Palestine for bringing this important event. And I agree, we often hear more about the noise is more about a suppression of speech and denying those kinds of conversations to take place than actually dealing with the substance of what is the right of return, what is the issue of occupation, what is the right to equality for Palestinian citizens, etc. So this is a really important opportunity, and I'm glad to be here. I should also start by saying that I'm speaking not on behalf of the ACLU. The ACLU, as a U.S. organization, does not take positions on foreign policy matters, particularly on violations of human rights in other countries, notwithstanding the important role that the United States plays in supporting the State of Israel. But I'm speaking here more in my personal capacity, based on my experience and work as a staff attorney of Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, as well as my many years of activism, legal activism and otherwise. So let me focus on a particular area that the organizers asked me to focus on today, which is the internally displaced Palestinians who became internal refugees within their own homeland, and specifically speaking or focusing on Palestinian citizens of Israel. Internal displacement within the history of Palestinian is an ongoing, unfortunate, ongoing experience. There's almost not a day that passes without some Palestinian, some form of forced displacement happens in historic Palestine, whether it happens in the Naqab, in the south of Israel, whether it's happening in the West Bank, whether it's happening in other parts of historic Palestine. So this is an issue that has not ceased to take place, and we need to recognize that. But I would want to really share with you the experience of Palestinian citizens of Israel, because it's always neglected angle or neglected part of the Palestinian history and experience. Despite the fact that the Palestinians became citizens of Israel in 1948, and at the time there were about 18-19% of Israel's population, and continue to be about the same size, 19-20% of Israel's population, and their existence as citizens did not immunize them, did not give them immunity from being displaced, being denied access to their historical lands, being denied to return to their own homes and lands that they have left or forced to leave during the 1948 war. And that experience is one that requires us to look at the political, legal, and diplomatic effort that went into sustaining by the State of Israel in the very beginning of the state, in the very first years, starting with declaring a state of emergency which, by the way, continues to exist until this day in Israel. So this, the state of Israel as a whole, not I'm not talking about the West Bank or Gaza, I'm talking about Israel proper, continues to this day to be under a state of emergency. Two, the second part was to use both a combination of force, other ways of, during the time of war, spread rumors of massacre going to happen, using all kinds of tactics that are really considered to be terror tactics under the Geneva Conventions that terrorize civilian populations in a time of war, in order to make sure that Palestinians, as many Palestinians, leave their land and their property and their houses and cities and towns, and make sure that at the time the Zionist militias and Zionist groups would take over those areas. And we don't have the time to go through the details of what happened during the war, because there's a lot of historians now have well documented, including Israeli historians, by the way, known as the new historians, that clearly show, in particular I want to mention Ilan Pappe as the one who consistently documented the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And as part of that process, there had to be also a way of legal regime in order to make sure that those Palestinian refugees who, for different reasons, left their homes and lands, were again forced, left, as it happens in every war, and I don't think that anyone would think that you would stay in your place put, despite the fact that you would be under the threat of being killed, being injured or massacred, to make sure that those individuals would not make it back, or at the very least would not be able to establish the same kind of relationship, whether it's a legal property rights or access of rights of freedom of movement, and able to establish some sort of precedent for the Palestinians to claim their land and property back. So the idea was, from the very beginning, as was mentioned earlier, seeing the right of return as an existential threat for the state of Israel. And that meant that that existential threat means not necessarily that by the return of Palestinian refugees, all of a sudden those refugees will be holding arms and will be killing Jews, but rather existential threat in changing the landscape of the state of Israel into one where there are people who would have to share the land on equal basis, where the privileges and the extra rights that were given under the State of Israel laws, starting with the law of a law of return and many other laws, would not break that kind of system of first-class citizenship for Israeli Jews and a second-class citizenship that has been afforded to Palestinian citizens. And particularly I want to mention the following. The fact that as many as 85% of the Palestinians, citizens of Israel, who remained within the state of Israel shortly after 1948, were living in areas that were declared as military areas. And these areas were three major areas, one in the north that covered major parts of the Galilee, one in the center, which covered major parts of the Triangle area, and one in the south, which covered big parts of the Negev, of the Naqab. And for that, that meant also to use additional laws under the state of emergency state situation in order to make sure that some areas will be declared closed military areas, some property would be confiscated under different rationales. One, for example, would be based under the absentee property law, which the Israeli Knesset passed in 1950. It replaced a temporary emergency law that was in place between 1948 to 1950, and basically it allowed the Israeli authorities to confiscate the land or to take custody over the land and to hand it over to the custodian of absentees, and that land was not transferred to the state yet until the Israeli Knesset had to pass another law in order to do that. Another form of prevention of Palestinian citizens who were part of the community of Palestinian communities who were pushed out and forced out of their communities. One other way was to declare some of the areas closed military areas, similar to what we hear now happening in the West Bank. And as such, that kind of technique or that kind of method allowed the state to say, well, you as a Palestinian, even though you are a citizen, you can't access this particular land. And if you had to access that, actually you had to get a permit because there was a permit system that was established under the military regime that existed between 1948 and 66. And because you are not, and later on, because the land was not used, cultivated, the Israeli authorities found the legal pretext to confiscate the land because the land was not used and cultivated, or for other national security reasons, whether the land was close to the border. What is important to remember in this struggle is that the internally displaced Palestinians that in 2000 numbered about 250,000, now they're about roughly 450,000 or so, and they live in different parts of the country, continue to have attachment and deep connections to their ruined and destroyed villages and communities. Although they had to relocate and live in those Palestinian villages that survived the 1948 war, and you're talking about, in 1948, you're talking about over 400 Palestinian villages and towns that were completely destroyed. And so some of the residents who were fortunate and lucky enough to be able to relocate and stay or even come back from neighboring Arab countries during the years between 1948 and the mid-50s were left with the option of living in current Palestinian towns and villages, like Nazareth, that absorbed a big number of internally displaced Palestinians. It's important also to mention that the Palestinians never said that we don't want to go back. They always wanted to exercise, and in fact, every year, Palestinians commemorate the Nakba by going to their ancestor lands, by going to their villages. Usually there's a national rally in one of those destroyed villages. And there's a lot of organizing going on, particularly under the umbrella of the National Committee on the Defense of the Rights of Internally Displaced Persons, or Palestinians, that started its activism in the mid-90s, following the Oslo Accords that completely ignored or completely sidelined the rights of Palestinian refugees, and in particular the rights of Palestinian internally displaced. So with that in mind, I wanted to, I don't know how much time we have left. I wanted to give you another example of a case study of how does actually that happen, in fact, for the Palestinian internally displaced. I want to give you an example of a village that that is very close to the Lebanese-Israeli border now, in the north of Palestine, called Ikrit. Ikrit is a Palestinian Christian village. Many people think that, you know, Palestinian people is only about one ethnic or religious group. Rather, it is actually very diverse. And one of the many Palestinian refugees were actually also coming from Palestinian, predominantly Palestinian Christian communities or villages. But the history of it is that if you go back to the history that was now more documented by historians, they show that Israeli authorities and Israeli Zionist groups and the government, as it started after its declaration in 1948, tried to avoid harming and forcing out Palestinian Christian communities because of the threat of a backlash in the international public opinion, particularly upsetting, you know, the Western countries, upsetting the Church, the Vatican, etc. And that has some maybe that may explain the reason why. There were more Palestinian, relatively speaking, more Palestinian Christian communities were able to survive the war and to stay and remain in their country. Now, that doesn't mean that there were no displacements and denial of the right to return for Palestinian Christians. As all Palestinian communities, regardless of religion, they were subject to the same plan of making sure that we would liberate those territories, take over, take control, military control over their territories, and make sure that we maintain as fewer number of Palestinians as possible. Because the idea of the Zionist project was to realize the Zionist project in the creation of a state of Israel that predominantly is a Jewish, or maintains a Jewish majority, is a Jewish state for the Jewish people. And the existence of non-Jews, and in fact you would hardly hear or see in the history of the records of the state of Israel reference to the words Palestinians. They would be either called non-Jews, they would be either called referred by their own religions, because Israel, after all, is a sectarian state, or they would be called, you know, all kinds of terminologies now used, Israeli Arabs, Arabs Israelis, and stuff like that, just to negate or to diminish the Palestinian identity of this community. And that plan included orders that were given to commanders and military commanders to do that. So those communities that were able to take refuge in nearby villages, my grandfather, who was participating in the hostilities as part of the local committees in the north, was in the fight, in the battlefield. My grandmother took her two sons and took refuge in an Arab Druze village near their town, and they were able to come back after the war was over. But my grandfather was still in detained as a prisoner of war in some camps that were actually where forced labor was done, and this is now documented, something that has been recently revealed as part of the International Committee of the Red Cross opening their archives in Geneva. And the case of Ikret is one that is interesting, because you see where even when the internally displaced Palestinians had a promise by the military commander to leave their village, to go and stay in a nearby village, in the village of Arami, while the hostilities end, while the war is until the war is over, yet they were not able to get back to their own country, and despite the fact that they were citizens. So for that matter, citizenship really did not give them an extra right other than the ability to remain and to, despite all the challenges and restrictions, even to file illegal challenges to the Israel Supreme Court. And in fact, the communities of Ikret filed a petition, one of the early petitions to be filed on behalf of internally displaced, as did other communities, Al-Ghabsiyyi and others. But Ikret's did particularly is important for legal scholars and lawyers, because the Supreme Court in the early days of the early 1950s actually did say that they have a certain right of return, and that they had a promise, and that promise should be fulfilled. While at the same time, the Israeli government took the decision to destroy their village, and they were not, and they declared the village entirely a closed military area, claiming that there was a national security reason for doing so, because it's very close to the Lebanese border. There were all kinds of infiltrators, Palestinian infiltrators, those inhabitants, native indigenous Palestinians, who were refugees trying to come back to their homeland, were forced by force stopped from coming in, coming back, and as a result, they were continued to struggle for the return. Their struggle obviously took a different nature because they are citizens, and then during the 1990s. There was another attempt, I'm going to skip that part, but there was another attempt to go to the court during the Begin government, and they had been told that for national security reasons, we defer to the government for their displacement, and they will not be able to go back. But hopefully, if things get better, they should return to their village. Subsequently, after the beginning of the Oslo Accords, the community continued to struggle for the return. And they said, while at the same time, a lot of the land was already taken and used by Jewish communities in that area. And the only two landmarks that remained in Ikrit, if you go, you can actually go and visit them today, is the cemetery and the church, and where people continue to bury their loved ones in that cemetery and go to the church wherever they are. You know, they marry people there, they go to the different ceremonies. But the point is, they were not able to go back, and only after specific advocacy, because of the fact that the Supreme Court in the early years determined that they actually have the right to go back to their land, the government was able to establish a ministerial committee that recommended to come to a plan where it will accommodate and will provide some sort of a plan for them to go back, but it will not include all of the land that was part of the village. It will be very limited to a particular area. They would create a communal village on a much very short or very small area, but they will at the same time there will be some sort of compensation given to others. Ultimately, this plan did not move forward, and it was rejected in terms of some people in the community rejected that as a way of negating their right to of return and full compensation and taking back their own lands, but also because of the political situation has changed in a way that allowed the government to say, no, that is actually not a good idea for us, even for such a small community of hundreds of people that are attached to the village of Ikrit. And the reason was, this is going to set a precedent for Palestinian right of return. And in fact, the last attempt of the village of Ikrit to get another chance before the Israel Supreme Court, Ariel Sharon's government at the time submitted a statement, a declaration, that said the government opposes their return because it fears to create this precedent. And their case has been dismissed, and to this day, they're going back to the organizing, to the ideal of returning, despite the fact that their laws or the courts have not been able to provide them with any remedy. So this is one example that represents the best scenario for, or best case for, Palestinian internally displaced, where they were not given any remedy, were not given any the recognition and the exercise of the right of return. And now Palestinians as a whole, internally displaced, continue to organize and think about ways of achieving, realizing their right as part of a Palestinian vision toward the future. 10 years ago, and I will close with that, 10 years ago, there were a number of important documents that were adopted by the Palestinian civil society, political leadership in Israel. They were called the vision documents. And those documents speak about the historic injustice that happened to the Palestinian people, but specifically focus on Palestinian rights within Israel. And they specifically address land and housing planning policies and the injustice that happened to the Palestinians with regard to confiscation of their land, particularly to internally displaced Palestinians. And in those documents, there is a demand on Israel not only to recognize them, to recognize the injustice, pay reparations, end structural racism, and end all these laws that confiscated land, but there's a specific demand for the State of Israel to look at the historic injustice that was done to the internally displaced Palestinians and to deal with this issue as part of the reconciliation, as part of making Israel a democratic state that is truly committed to equal citizenship while recognizing the right of all people in that country. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamil. I want to hand it over next to Emilio.
Thank you. Thank you so much to the organizers for considering me for this event. In my work in Palestine at the International Law and Human Rights Program in East Jerusalem, I have been insistently trying to advance a more critical scholarship on internal Palestinian law, PA's law. Basically, this has been totally ignored. But I said that I have been trying to advance some more critical scholarship on Palestinian PA's law, because for a strange reason, some of them understandable, these PA laws have been somehow ignored by critical scholarship, and many times I have found myself trying to justify why I'm working on a PA's legislative production. Many people say, what is the importance? We are under occupation, we don't have an state, so what is the importance of PA laws? Why are you studying that? I think you are losing your time. Some people ask me, in what sense has Palestinian PA legal production changed, even slightly, the real life of Palestinian people? And I would like to try to respond to this question. How or has effectively Palestinian PA laws changed anything on the ground? To this question, I would like simply to reply, at the risk of raising eyebrows, that PA's legal regime, though it did not deliver its promises, and that I can agree, has participated in the transformation of almost every aspect of our life that Oslo brought about in occupied Palestine and beyond. Oslo, the inception of the PA and its legal structures, carried with them a new cognitive grid for social meaning and political action, and that strongly impacted on refugees' fate. These transformations are of material, symbolic, and discursive nature. They advance categories of perception violently departing from those before Oslo, and their pervasive impact explain that Palestinian contemporary politics is not fully understandable within the pre-Oslo categories of social and political meaning. Indeed, how to explain otherwise that demonstrations, for example, in Ramallah to support Palestinian prisoners in hunger strike would gather only a handful of supporters, while people continue shopping and very often seem to have only disdain for the demonstrators. How to explain, how else to explain that today Fatah, for example, can see Israel as a potential ally in their fight against Hamas? How can we understand that Palestinian security services repress and torture Palestinians to protect Israel, share intelligence, and assist Israeli security services in their own repression of Palestinians? How to explain that Abbas and other public officers can publicly insist and defend the sacred nature of security coordination with the Israelis without being unanimously labeled as traitors and punished in the way that they were before Oslo? How to make sense of the fact that prominent members of the Palestinian bourgeoisie in occupied Palestine can host and offer dinners in their own houses to Israeli military officials on the 15th of May to celebrate Israeli independence? How to understand all the ways in which Palestinian elites today normalize relations with Israel in the field of businesses, academia, and politics? All this does not only remind us of Fanon's idea that anti-colonialist struggle is not automatically written from a nationalist perspective, but it also forces us to revisit all these pre-Oslo ideas that we take for granted. without trying to romanticize the history of the Palestinian national movement, the fact is that some old categories of perception in the Palestinian society, which were generally structured around some common experiences, statuses, practices, and objectives, for example, the territorialized national movement, a scattered people with the same national objectives and a shared sense of identity, subjected to exile or occupation and fighting a common enemy, all these have been patently changed or have been redefined. And my point is that severely impacting on the fate of refugees. And my point is that PA laws have contributed to these transformations. Living in Ramallah for the last 8 years and researching on law, I have been directly exposed to the fact that the PA's institutions and legal production are not just the silent and passive products of social and political forces, but they also have a performative ability to produce social reality. First, these legal structures facilitated and consolidated the emergence of new social groups, divisions, hierarchies, etc. Second, the PA's legal regime has advanced new forms and sources of authority, legitimacy, social status, subjectivity, identities, and categories of social meaning that reinforce these changes. Third, legal and institutional processes promoted particular discursive practices and strategies that, while emphasizing the concept of peace process, institutional building, statehood, economic development, and the language of rights and law at the expenses of the real end to colonial rule, seemed to progressively reorganize social and political action in and around Palestine. In the symbolic realm, the PA legal structures have not only served to institutionalize, legitimize, and consolidate specific avenues for political and social action that guarantee and reinforce the reproduction of its social order, but they have also contributed to the redefinition of identities. As Combi emphasizes, since identity is not only a matter of the roles of individuals or their own identification, but also of the categorization of individuals or groups by the state, institutions and other groups, identity may also be delineated from the outside. The redefinition of identities produced by Oslo legal structures included the very concept of who is a Palestinian and directly impacted on refugees. Indeed, before Oslo, the prevailing notion of Palestinian was defined by the PLO Charter as those Arab citizens who were normally living in Palestine up to 1947, and every child who was born to a Palestinian father after this date, whether in Palestine and outside. This was a Palestinian. Anyone normally living in Palestine until 1947 and their descendants. Even though this definition has not technically changed, Oslo's frame and laws symbolically, but also practically, has reduced this notion of Palestinians to the inhabitants of the West Bank and Gaza, progressively excluding Palestinians in Israel, refugees and diaspora from the political process. Indeed, this can be metaphorically illustrated by the fact that Article 34 of the amended Basic Law of 2003, the current constitutional text, even if suspended, states that the president, the Palestinian constitution says that the president is elected in a general and direct election by the Palestinian people. Article 97 prescribes that the ruling of the court shall be announced and executed in the name of the Palestinian Arab people. Moreover, the preamble of the draft Basic Law from the very first reading stated that the power and legitimacy of the Basic Law arises from the will of the Palestinian people. In all these cases, the constitutional text is silent on the fact that the only Palestinians who are part of the PA's political and legal processes are the inhabitants of the West Bank and Gaza, whereby excluding the majority of Palestinians living outside the occupied territories, refugees and diaspora. The electoral law of 95, for example, clarified and strengthened this point by defining an elector as every Palestinian inhabitant of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including Jerusalem. Furthermore, and even though more than 50% of the Palestinian people live outside the Palestinian territory and are forbidden from entering, to be eligible for president or to be elected to the parliament, the electoral law requires voters to have a fixed residential address inside the Palestinian territory. Further exclusion of large parts of the Palestinian people, as understood in the PLO Charter, from the PA's legal and discursive imaginary has been objectified in law. For example, Article 7 of the same electoral law, after establishing the cases in which someone qualifies as a Palestinian for the purposes of voting or running for elections, sets a general condition, which is that the person has not acquired Israeli citizenship, excluding ipso facto Palestinians in Israel. In turn, the law of NGOs of 1999 forbids the participation of Palestinians from Israel in the administration of these institutions. Thus, Palestinians inside Israel maintain a complex relation with the authority characterized by their blurred position in the PA's imaginary and their lack of institutional links with it. Moreover, the status of Palestinians inside Israel was not even discussed in Oslo, neither during the drafting of the Basic Law nor during the drafting of the definitive Palestinian constitution for the state. Even though the identification of the Palestinians inside Israel with the Palestinian cause is not in doubt, there are virtually no trans-border Israel-Palestinian territory structures of Palestinian political mobilization. In this context, the Palestinian organizations inside Israel increasingly orient their work to the defense of their interest as a minority inside Israel, and in these efforts, their interlocutor is primarily the Israeli state. It plays perfectly into the Israeli strategy of disassociating this population from the Palestinian national struggle. Regarding refugees outside Palestine in other countries, it is worth noting that in 96 and 2006 Palestinian elections, no efforts were made to materialize the participation of refugees and diaspora Palestinians. In contrast to the election, to the elections in other countries with similar conditions of occupation such as Iraq and Afghanistan. Not really surprising, given that as early as 1994, Nabil Shaad, ex-foreign minister, stated that, and quote, Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, that was in 94, that Palestinian refugees in Lebanon were not the PA's responsibility but UNRWA's. In 94 also, Ziad Abu Ziad, PLC member, the PA's parliament, PLC member and PA minister, distinguished between the principle of the right of return and its actual applicability of return to the homeland and to that same home, piece of land, which a certain Palestinian owned before 1948. According to Abu Ziyad, Palestinians should enjoy the principle of the right of return, but it is more realistic application would be to attract them to a future Palestinian state. In 2010, Abu Mazen himself declared before a Jewish North American audience, quote, I would never deny the Jewish right to the land of Israel, overlooking the fact that the Jewish right to the land has been based on the denial of the right of return for Palestinian refugees. Indeed, from the beginning of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in Madrid and later in Oslo, Israel imposed as a condition the exclusion of refugees from the discussions. In the agreements themselves, this solution was accepted and the refugee issue was left for final status talks. Moreover, the Oslo agreements simply excluded any reference to the UN General Assembly Resolution 194, to the UN Charter, or international law at all. Later, Arafat himself suggested the idea that the right of return may be renounced for some categories of refugees, and a solution to the refugees within an agreement acceptable to Israel, which meant subjecting Resolution 194 to various interpretations. This evolution in refugee status has brought about an increasing uncertainty regarding who is a Palestinian within the PA institutional frame and in whose name PA officials speak. Refugees have found their rights gradually excluded from the PA's political claims and see with suspicion an authority which is likely willing to give up their rights in order to obtain political results in their bargaining with Israel. I want to conclude by saying that from the PA standpoint, incorporating refugees in the political process has become dangerous in that it may put at stake its own political and institutional power. In this context, one cannot expect but an increasing exclusion of the refugees from the PA's imaginary and political agenda. Thank you.
And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.